A woman is shot after attempting to drive through White House barriers. That 2 weeks after a shooting rampage at the Navy shipyard. In both cases, mental illness was thought to be a factor. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, at the start of National Mental Illness Awareness Week, we talk with a Cedar Rapids resident who's been diagnosed with schizophrenia. We'll get his thoughts about mental illness in the news. We'll also talk with a psychiatrist about progress in treating mental illness and about the major restructuring of mental health services currently going on in Iowa. Has mental illness touched you or a loved one? Tell us what you think of Iowa's mental health services. We start right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Good evening. Once again, the country is trying to make sense of an irrational act of violence by someone with mental health issues. We may never know for sure why Miriam Carey, a 34-year-old single mom from Connecticut, drove to Washington yesterday and set off a security scare from one end of Pennsylvania Avenue.
A woman is shot after attempting to drive through White House barriers. That comes 2 weeks after a shooting rampage at the Navy shipyard. And in both of the cases, in national news, mental illness was thought to be a factor. This hour, at the start of National Mental Illness Awareness Week, we want to spend the hour discussing several facets of mental illness in the wake of those recent shootings, including that one at the Navy Yard. We want to ask why some are pointing to increased need for mental health care. We'll also examine discuss a link or lack thereof of violence, mental illness. In that connection, also the stigma surrounding mental illness. And later in the program, we'll discuss the Iowa Mental Health Redesign. It was signed into law back in 2011. We'll check to see what the impact of this transition is so far and as it moves into the future, what is happening. We'll also talk about one of Iowa's largest residential care facilities for people with mental illness. It's shut its doors for good, the Abbey Center for Community Care in Linn County. Will have its former president joining us in just a bit. We want to reach out to you also this hour. Has mental illness affected you or a loved one? Tell us what you think of Iowa's mental health services and the current redesign going on. 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can also find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining me first of all, and for the entire hour, Steve Miller is with us. He is a resident of Cedar Rapids. He has been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. He's also on the Consumer Council Executive Committee for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Steve Miller, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks to be here.
And congratulations, I understand, are in order. You were recently honored with the Ken Steele Award. This is an award given by NAMI's Consumer Council to recognize outstanding contributions by an individual living with mental illness to improve the quality of life, increase empowerment, and promote integration and inclusion for other individuals living with mental illness. Congratulations for that.
I appreciate that. It was always a nice thing to have done. And I got to tell you, after I gave my little acceptance speech, I pulled my harmonic out and played a little tune on it.
You did. And how was that received?
And everybody stood up and yelled.
That's good. Time for celebration. Steve, let me get your reaction in particular. As someone who has suffered from mental illness, as I mentioned, diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, we had the Navy shipyard shooter, Aaron Alexis, under, according to reports, the delusional belief he was being controlled by or influenced by extremely low-frequency electromagnetic waves. More recently, Miriam Carey, the 34-year-old dental hygienist, running her car into a White House barrier, leading the police on a chase before she was shot. Evidently, last December, she told police she was a prophet, that President Obama would place her city under a lockdown, and that her residence was under electronic surveillance. What are your thoughts when mental illness figures into the news so prominently as it has in the past weeks and months?
I mean, this is something we always cringe about when these things happen, because most of these shootings, mental health is an issue. And it's something where these people are slipping through the cracks. And they say one out of two people in our country are getting treatment, so one out of two are not. When the Navy Yard thing happens, we're just hoping and praying that it's not mental health, but it's just the nature of mental illness. And being sick for so long, I was sick for 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was never violent or anything like that, but I can understand how the brain can malfunction so intensely and so horribly.
Mm-hmm. Do you talk with others? I imagine you have a community of people who suffer from or have suffered from mental illness. When something like this happens, do you talk amongst yourselves?
We try to figure it out and try to make common sense out of it. But these things don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to stay light about it. And we try to help other people all we can. It's just, I mean, there's millions and millions of people with mental health issues. And when the mind is not working properly, some things can happen that aren't good, actually.
What have you thought of the media coverage of this? And I don't know how much TV or radio or newspapers, online content you consume, but do you generally think that in these most recent cases that the media has done a good job of treating mental illness aspects of these stories accurately and fairly?
I see both sides. I think I see more of a majority knocking mental health rather than those who are supporting the shooter. I know a gal that says the shooter is the victim of a victim, which I thought was an interesting statement. So it's hard. It's hard, Ben.
Mm-hmm. Steve Miller, before we move on here, I'd like to have us, if you would, help us out in understanding your situation, because fortunately most of us do not suffer from mental illness, and to give us a little bit of a picture into the struggle that you've been in the last 17 years. How did it start? What happened?
Well, I was off of my freshman year of college, and I was getting pretty sick, and I was self-medicating. And even one day I thought, you know, there's something wrong with me. I went over to the local infirmary, and it was closed on a Sunday, first time I reached out. So I came home and got sick. I mean, I got, like I was saying, I was catatonic, delusional, hallucinating.
What were you hallucinating about, for instance?
I was having auditory hallucinations. Mm-hmm. You know, it's to me, a lot of people will say, well, they're telling them to jump off the house, you know, kill somebody. Mine sounded like a group of people sitting around a dinner table eating. The old medications, the only good thing it did for me was stop auditory hallucinations. So anyways, got sick. We don't know what to do. We go down to the ER after a short intake. Boom, I'm up in the psych unit. And that was the start of dealing with my mental health.
Mm-hmm. And then you received treatment, and what the psych unit was where?
I was up in St. Luke's, up in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
So I went for 10 years on an older medicine that had been around since, I think Dr. Witters can speak to this, around 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was 79, so we're talking old treatments that weren't effective, but then the new atypicals, they call them, came out in 89, and I was like the happiest guy that there ever was. It was working. I was my thoughts were clearing. I could start feel some good again. I had forgotten what it felt like to have a brain that was wired up properly, and I was just like the happiest guy.
Right. And so tell us about your life today, Steve, living with mental illness, but you have a medication that seems to be working just fine.
Yeah, yeah. And I have a reason to get out of bed every day, you know. There's some limitations I have, but there's some good things I can do. I'm just finishing up a book I've been writing the last year and a half that I'm hopeful for, and I do trainings around the country, and I speak a little bit around the country, so I was sick for 17 years, but then the next 17, I feel pretty fortunate.
I understand you're going to be part of a panel discussion coming up. Tell us about that.
Actually, the panel is something that I'm helping put on. Mm-hmm. But Thursday night at First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids, Thursday night at 5:30, dessert, 6 o'clock, we're having a program, and we're going to be talking mental health, substance abuse, and the criminal justice system. So you're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Invite to all our listeners as well. When you speak nationally and go out and and spread a message. What are the key points you want to get across?
I mean, the first thing I want people to do is understand what mental illness really is. It's not these big public things. That is not the norm. The norm is people trying to get by day to day the best they can. They're trying to be a part of the community. They're trying to, you know, just be in a position of being comfortable with their lives and accepting. And I just need people to know, you know, those horrendous things are a horrendous thing, but they are also a very, very, very small minority of the population with mental health issues.
Okay. If you just joined us, Steve Miller, one of my guests this hour, as we discuss mental illness and during the start of National Mental Illness Awareness Week, you heard him refer to Dr. Witter in just a moment ago. Dr. Alan Witters is the chief of psychiatry at Cedar Rapids Mercy Medical Center in our Iowa City studio. Dr. Witters, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
You're sitting there listening to Steve's story there, his struggle with mental illness and the current happy ending that it has. How many people out there are suffering from similar, in terms of intensity, the types of mental illness out there in our Iowa community?
Well, right now, the estimate of people with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder is estimated to be about 7 million Americans.
Mm-hmm. And how do you define those disorders? We heard some of the symptoms that Steve discussed there.
Schizophrenia is associated with auditory hallucinations, typically, that is, hearing voices that tell people or comment on their action, as well as delusions. Delusions are a fixed false belief that no matter what someone may try to convince them otherwise, there is just no convincing.
We call them hallucinations or delusions, but to that person, and Steve, back me up on this, it is as real as anything, right?
I mean, and people will say, you know, that's not real. I mean, that there's nobody around you making those noises, but to the person actually experiencing it, it's very real and happening to them.
Mm-hmm. So when we have you're a psychiatrist, you've been in practice for nearly 30 years, I understand?
That is correct.
What is your take when we hear mental illness in the news, unfortunately, with tragedies such as we've had at the Navy shipyard, also the woman who was unfortunately shot in Washington, D.C.? What are your observations, your thoughts?
Well, typically, as Steve mentions, this is a brain disease. It is a minority of people with schizophrenia do have any violent tendencies, and certainly there is a much greater tendency to be victimized and to be stigmatized rather than being a perpetrator of that violence.
Those with mental illness are more likely to be victims of violence than to perpetrate violence.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Even there is that other side of the coin where a person believes that, similar to Aaron Alexis at the Naval Shipyard, who feels that he was being bombarded by microwaves or what have you, and he's trying to preserve the reality and to protect that which he sees as valuable. It's not an evil thing.
So explain again, what do you believe, based on the reports, he was trying to do by shooting all those people?
He, in his mind, it was a rational approach, but his mind was irrational and was not making any sense. But with all, whether it be in Connecticut or Tucson or Virginia Tech, or even Iowa City with the Gang Liu murders, mass murders, these are people that are trying to do the best they can do given their limitations.
Mm-hmm. So do we know what percentage of mentally ill people would fall into the category of potentially dangerous?
I can't actually give – that's somewhat controversial given – we do know that there are greater predictors of violence, such as being male, single, loner, substance abuser. But nevertheless, there is, and especially in the last 7 years, there have been 23 different mass shootings, and over half of them did involve a psychotic illness, and typically where or that did not receive any treatment at that time, either due to lack of access to that psychiatric treatment or the person refusing to have that treatment.
Mm-hmm. A few moments ago, Steve Miller, you said slipping through the cracks was your interpretation of some of the things going on. Dr. Witters, is that how you see it, that we are just not doing a good enough job at identifying the potentially dangerous people and getting them to treatment?
It is not only a matter of people identify violent behaviors and fearful things, but it's a matter of not being able to force treatment unless a person is eminently a danger to themselves or others. And sometimes that, you know, people are feeling very frustrated that they can't get a loved one to get treatment. Our commitment laws are such where 60 Minutes, I think last Sunday, had an episode where the joke is you have to either tell your psychiatrist that you're going to kill him or try to attempt suicide in order to get someone committed into involuntary treatment.
Does that tell you that something about our system, our laws concerning this are broken, need some repair?
Certainly the commitment laws are something that needs to be strengthened, in my opinion. And as we'll find in the second half of this show, ways of what our society will allow. Our society somehow thinks that deinstitutionalization, there was a half a million people with schizophrenia who were released from state hospitals. That was the greatest number of beds. Now there's only 5% of the psychiatric beds that there were in the early 60s. Now we put people in prison, and that's why I was so happy to hear what Steve doing this the meeting that's happening on this Thursday, is that what somehow our prisons and the Wall Street Journal just came out last week saying that Iowa was tied for being the worst state in the country in terms of people with serious mental illness that being incarcerated. And that's over half of all of our prisoners do have a psychiatric disorder. So somehow our society is saying prison and jail is better for psychiatric patients than getting active treatment.
If you've just joined us, Dr. Alan Witters is with us, Chief of Psychiatry at Cedar Rapids Mercy Medical Center, along with Steve Miller. He's a Cedar Rapids resident and sharing his experience as someone who has been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. River to River listeners, if mental illness has affected you or a loved one, we'd like to hear from you, especially pertaining to Iowa's mental health services as they go through a redesign. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in our second half hour. But we want to hear how you have been treated, what you've thought of the mental health services in Iowa. And again, if you have been mentally ill or are mentally ill, or you have a loved one who's been affected by mental illness, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, and you can tweet us at IPR Talk if you'd like to do that. Steve Miller, back to you. I know one of the things you like to talk about when you speak in Iowa or around the country about mental illness for NAMI is the stigma that surrounds it. And we have had decades of stigma, more than decades, going back centuries, stigma connected with mental illness. Explain to me how you see, what is the nature of the stigma that you encounter when people see or find out that you have a mental illness.
Well, one time I didn't understand stigma, and I took out the dictionary and took a peek, and it said ashamed, being ashamed. And I thought, you know, I'm not ashamed I have mental illness. And I don't think most people are. And why should I be ashamed of something that, you know, I feel okay, and I feel like I'm doing okay. So.
And you had no control over it. I mean, getting it, having this condition.
Yeah, true, yeah.
It's like being ashamed of a heart condition, isn't it, Dr. Witters?
Well, I just want to mention that that's the greatest problem when these stories come out is the stigma that even though Steve is not ashamed, other people discriminate against things that they don't understand, and they overestimate the risk that they have. And I mean, and I wish more people would have Steve's perspective and realize that this is a brain disease, and it is nothing to be ashamed of.
No.
What types of encounters have you had in public, for instance, or perhaps with friends or family that tell you this person is discriminating against
you? I see both sides. Family, close friends, people I've known over the years, you know, they say, hey, Steve, you know, he's okay guy. We don't care what his situation is, you know. But there's other people, you know, you might be introduced to somebody and they, you know, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm in the mental health field. And they'll say, well, what do you do? And dig around a little bit. And I may eventually say, well, you know, I have a mental health issue myself. And sometimes that person will turn around and walk away right away. So that's some of that.
Still to this day.
Still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Share your experiences, 1-866-780-9100. We have to go to a break in just a moment, but we're talking about mental illness this whole hour as a part of the start of National Mental Illness Awareness Week. And when we come back, we want to talk about Iowa's redesign here, but we have a minute or two left here. And let me turn in that remaining time for this segment to Dr. Alan Witters of Cedar Rapids Mercy Medical Center. How would you characterize the progress that has been made, and you've been in practicing for some three decades, in treating mental illness?
Well, as Steve had mentioned, with his previous treatment, he had a lot of negative symptoms, that is, lack of motivation, lack of energy. The hallucinations and delusions were improved, but it was the negative symptoms that remained until some of the newer agents that have come out. Has a different set of side effects, but it has then allowed many of my patients to regain that motivation and energy and creativity, such as what Steve has demonstrated.
Mm-hmm. So you're getting more, you're using as a psychiatrist more effective medications are being developed with fewer side effects, less harmful side effects, and they're more effective themselves in doing what they're asked to do.
Absolutely, but every pill always has side effects, and sometimes you trade one for another.
Okay, looking for your mental illness experiences this hour as we discuss it. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. When we come back in just a moment, we want to talk about the closing of a facility here in Iowa. It's called Abbey. We'll find out about how that fits into Iowa's mental health service redesign when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support comes from the U.S.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, at the start of National Mental Illness Awareness Week, we're spending an hour discussing several facets of mental illness, also in the news. This half hour, and in a moment, we want to get into discussing the major restructuring of mental health services currently going on in Iowa. We want to hear from you as well. Has mental illness affected you or a loved one? Tell us what you think the Iowa Mental Health Service has done for you. How that's been treating you. 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. coming over from the first half hour into our second half hour, Steve Miller is with us, Cedar Rapids resident, and he is a spokesperson for NAMI and a person who has been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. If you heard our first hour, half hour, we're talking about how he's been gone through that struggle, and today, under medication, can live a great life and talk with us about firsthand experiences about having mental illness. Also, Dr. Alan Witters is with us, Chief of Psychiatry at Cedar Rapids Mercy Medical Center. He's been in practice for nearly 30 years in this area. Before we move on, and we do want to get to phone calls here in just a moment, Dr. Witters, after tragedies like Sandy Hook or the Navy shipyard shooting, gun laws come under discussion. And when gun laws are discussed in Washington or in states, mental health is one aspect of that. What can you say about what progress might be made or what parts of gun laws should be addressing mental health that are not now?
Thanks. You know, one of the things, Ben, that I have been concerned with is the access of automatic weapons. I mean, I'm a hunter, or I have been a hunter, and I have a lot of concerns regarding weapons of mass destruction, essentially, where someone can kill very quickly without doing much of a thinking. I mean, I think people that have that have been shown to be a danger to themselves or others, I do have a lot of concerns that they not be allowed to have weapons that are very easily can hurt them, primarily themselves, because most of the guns that especially a lot of the firearms end up on either themselves or on family members. And so that's part of my concern, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's my own soap opera.
Is it clear which mental illnesses should disqualify someone from owning a weapon?
It's not that simple. The state of Iowa does indicate that a person that has been committed, who is under commitment, cannot have a firearm while they're under commitment.
Okay. I want to introduce Dan Strelner, also in our Iowa City studio, president of Abbey, Inc., and also a former president of Abbey, the Abbey Center for Community Care, one of Iowa's largest residential care facilities for people with mental illness. Dan Strelner, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
Dan, within the past few days, September 30th, one of Iowa's largest residential care facilities for people with mental illness shut its doors for good. The Abbey Center for Community Care in Linn County had a capacity, I understand, to house over 200 people at a time, in operation for 37 years. Tell us the background. What were the reasons for the Abbey Center closing?
Well, Abbey Center was originally established in 1987 in order to provide an alternative from some of the larger institutional placements like the Mental Health Institute and even inpatient psychiatric treatment at the time. Very proud of the types of treatment that we were able to provide over that time. There have been some shifts in public policy over the last few years that have contributed to closing facilities like ours. And the difficulties really started in fiscal year 2012 with Linn County, a mental health budget deficit of $5.4 million. And at that time, we had approximately 127 individuals in our facility in active residential treatment, not custodial care, but in active treatment, working on medication adjustments, moving from inpatient hospitals back to the community and those sorts of things. At that time, there was also the movement toward regionalization or mental health redesign in Iowa, which brought about a lot of uncertainty about what the roles of residential facilities like Abbey Center for Community Care were.
And this is a big part of the redesign, going from a county system to a regional system?
That's correct. And I think the intent of the regionalization is good. I think everybody wants access to mental health services at the right time for folks when they need them. To be governed at a regional, provided at a local level, and that makes some sense. But it also brought a lot of uncertainty, and there's still a lot of uncertainty to this day about what's going to be paid for by various regions and those sorts of things. So over that period of time, we continue to provide services. We continue to work with individuals on moving into the community, those sorts of things, and helping stabilize individuals with mental health issues so that they could move back to the community. But the uncertainty and the of whether there would be transition funding available from the state, whether regions would choose to pay for residential care facilities in the future when regionalization is actually implemented and in effect, as well as the fact that residential care was denied status as a core service in legislation. What that meant basically was that regions don't have to pay for residential care facilities. And that was a real blow to residential care facilities.
So where did all these people go? I understand there was a two-month notice for the staff at the Abbey Center. Where are all the people now who were served by the Abbey Center?
Well, during the period of time that all these things were taking place, you know, we were working on a plan, obviously, to what would happen if we had to make the decision to close. And so when we made the decision to close on September 30th, we did that with a 60-day notice, actually. And I can tell you that we had 76 people still residents at the time. And let's see, 62-65% of those folks were discharged to other residential care facilities. Or intermediate care facilities, or either left us against medical advice or were hospitalized after the 30th. About 28% or 21 of those individuals were discharged to a 24-hour supervised site. In other words, maybe a home with 24-hour supervision in the community. And about 10% were discharged to less than 24-hour settings, which means they might have went home with a family member, they might have left and gone home with a friend. So about 85 to 90% of all the people that were in the facility at the time were discharged to other 24-hour supervised settings.
And when we look at the big picture, the closing of Abbey Center represents what when we put it in the context of Iowa's mental health services?
Well, I think when you – sounds kind of crass, but when you take 75 or 76 beds out of the system, these folks still have to go somewhere. It also puts a little bit more pressure on the psychiatric inpatient units locally, the emergency rooms, as well as the jails. Because there are folks that are going to require a little bit longer stay or a little longer period of stabilization before they can function back to their optimal level again.
Dan Strelner, president of Abbey, Inc. Let's go to Chris Hoffman. He's in our Cedar Falls studio, executive director of Pathways Behavioral Services. That's a nonprofit corporation licensed by the Iowa Department of Public Health. It offers substance abuse and mental health prevention and treatment services to six Northeast Iowa counties. Chris Hoffman, thank you for coming in.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Give us your perspective on the redesign, the transition that's going on right now from a county system to a regional system.
As Dan mentioned earlier, I think a number of the goals of the regionalization were very positive ones and ones we would strive for. But we also need to look at it in the context of how the Wall Street Journal, which was referenced in the previous half hour, has judged how well Iowa's doing. And so we've kind of covered a lot of territory so far in our discussion. And one thing I'm hoping I can bring to this that if everybody walks away doesn't remember anything else, remembers,
sure,
we have to be concerned about the maintenance of the safety net set of services that need to be out there if we want to keep our mental health population out of our prison system. You have to have a set of services out there for them to access wherever they need to access them so we can prevent those things. It's a lot less expensive to keep somebody out of prison by providing a reasonable set of services than it is to put them in. My concern with some of the regionalization is we may look at the restructuring as going to a system of lowest bidder gets the contracts, and that's not necessarily the best way to provide a good continuum of services.
1-866-780-9100 to join our conversation. We want to get to our phones very quickly, but what would you say, Chris Hoffman, what would be your message then for lawmakers in the way forward? If it sounds like you're agreeing with the idea in the Wall Street Journal article that was quoted before that Iowa is not doing really a passing grade in this area.
One of the opportunities I've had is to sit on the work group with the Department of Human Services to look at outcomes expected by the regions. And the issue that we're trying to push through that group is that outcomes are expected to be a work in progress and not static. We don't want them just to be a floor for what the expectations for the regions are, but a quality improvement process. I would hope lawmakers would be able to support that piece of what we want to do with client surveys and so forth in order to make sure that what's getting designed is actually providing services for people as they need them and not just meeting a dry set of criteria so that they don't get a problem with their funders or something later.
Okay, on this point, before we go to callers, Dr. Witters, you had something to
yeah,
point
I just,
out?
Just wanted to go ahead and say, number one, much of what is happening is placement in HAB homes. And the problem is we cannot commit people to HAB homes. Number two, in terms of the funding, that was vetoed by Governor Branstad. And if we had some extra funds to allow this transition to go ahead, it would certainly go very far in terms of allowing psychiatric beds, such as at Mercy Hospital or at St. Luke's Hospital, which are constantly full, and our emergency rooms are constantly full, just waiting beds available on our closed psychiatric floor.
Okay. Very quickly, Steve Miller.
I just think I need to point out that everybody is at a different level in their recovery. Some people need more intense services, others need less, and there's the whole gray area of in between.
Okay, let's go to our phones. I've been promising that for a while. I want to make good on that promise. David is with us from Silvis. Hi, David. What's your angle on this conversation?
Well, first off, I just like to say that, you know, the mental illness, there's a very wide range of severity and types. So just, you know, and my oldest brother had mental illness, and I don't know exactly what his diagnosis was. But he was a violent person at times and was institutionalized most of his early life. While I was away in the Navy, in the 60s, he was released from Mount Pleasant, I believe, when they either reduced it severely or closed. I can't remember which. But he was not actually able to care for himself well. But he was released anyway and, you know, was not able to hold a job because of his mental illness. And, you know, just ended up in a very poor state of health and passed away at what I would consider an early age.
You think I'm sorry to hear that. You think we could have done better here in Iowa?
I think so. You know, I think, you know, I know that, you know, funding is always an issue, but, you know, I really personally don't feel he should have been released totally, or if released maybe to some sort of halfway house where he would have had some sort of supervision.
Okay. David, we've got some other people waiting. I want to thank you very much for sharing your story.
Okay. Thank you.
Penny is with us in Grinnell. Hi, Penny.
Well.
Hi. You had a question or a comment?
Oh, I had a comment. I moved to Iowa just a few years ago, so I'm not sure of the social policy changes that have taken place. But when I moved, I started working in the mental health field, particularly with children and adolescents with mental health diagnoses. And one of the things that I want to point out is there seems to be a real shortage of qualified professionals who can treat mental health issues in children and adolescents, and then particularly in rural communities, the services are not readily available. So oftentimes families are finding themselves driving maybe an hour, hour and a half, or 2 hours to a larger urban setting where they can access help. And for families who are struggling with mental health issues or poor socioeconomic status, that's a real hardship for them.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of the county areas, or when you can't find somebody who can treat an adolescent with a mental health issue, the wait time to get into that person is often 6 months or more. Unfortunately, families often don't try to access services until they're at crisis point. So at that point, to ask them to wait 6 months to get in to see somebody is a real hardship. So that was my comment.
Penny, thank you very much. I think Dr. Witters will comment on that, and perhaps others, maybe Chris Hoffman as well. But Dr. Witters, the two aspects there, the rural health care, mental health care, and kids in this picture.
Well, I'm speaking to the lack of mental health professionals in rural communities, and I have been involved through various outreach facilities such as Abbey Manchester, and currently I continue to do telemedicine involving the emergency room just to answer that definite problem that we have in Iowa. In terms of having qualified people that can take care of adolescents and child, to a large degree, it's a matter of having more professionals available. And I don't want to say this. If you want to have more professionals in a particular area, you pay them more. Psychiatrists get paid the least amount of any of the physicians of all specialties.
Chris Hoffman, would you like to react to our caller as well in Cedar Falls?
Yeah,
you cover six counties.
We cover six counties. The only urban one is Black Hawk, and by some standards, that's sort of urban. And that's the challenge that we have. We have actually satellite offices in five of the six counties that we work in. The challenge in those counties is you have to have enough volume to support my professional staff to be there. Versus the county wanting you there all the time, and that balance is always difficult. We're solving some of our problems with telemedicine. That's working out very well. We have yet to be given permission to try to do other type of therapies outside of medication therapies and so forth that way. But the challenges of all the people just to get to our satellite office even are oftentimes difficult to overcome. We try to do so with case management and other services like that. But the rural areas are possibly one of the bright spots with some of the redesign. If we can find a way to recognize what the access issues are and try to develop a formula to subsidize the capacity to have good access points available.
Are there other states we can look to as models?
I haven't really found one yet. Iowa is pretty rural. When I look at things, other places that are as rural as us have similar challenges. I have relationships in Texas. They have some similar challenges. Some of the states solve the problem by paying better rates. As Dr. Witter said, if you pay people well enough, they may be a little more willing to move to New Hampton or someplace like that than not.
Dr. Witters?
Yeah, I just want to mention, I practiced in New Zealand about 3 years ago, and their system is completely different, and that's some things that we need to look about in this state and in the delivery of health care. Much of this is done by ancillary professionals, and then it's a different way to solve this problem. But there are lots of ways.
Okay, let's go to Lori in McClure. I'm sorry we don't have much time, Lori. I can give you a minute. What would you like to share with us?
I've been diagnosed with bipolar for probably about 12, 13, 14 years. I'm not quite sure. But part of my problem is I forget things quite a bit. It's getting me into trouble because, you know, I could lose everything. I could lose my home and everything. I just wondered if the question I wanted to ask you all was what signs do I need to look at, or symptoms that I need to look at that tells me that my problem is getting worse or better? Because I'm having problems right now.
Okay, Lori, you have a health care provider, Dr. Witters. What can we tell her in closing?
And
here?
Ben, I think that's exactly correct. Is what we tell Lori is that she needs to talk to her mental health professional. It's always the best person to deal with.
Okay, Lori, we hope you'll do that. Thank you for sharing your story here. I want to go out perhaps with this email from Jen we received, Jen listening to the program this hour. My son has had mental health issues, writes Jen, his whole life. Getting the right treatments is guess and check. What does she mean by guess and check? Just try something out. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't?
That's the
way I interpret it. Okay, I thought it was a term perhaps more widely used. Continuing with what she wrote, and much more research needs done, writes Jen. If we had more children, fewer economic resources, less quality health insurance. I'm not sure what we would do. My priority now is to help my child to, one, learn about his illness and how to accommodate it in ways that are developmentally appropriate so he can reach his full potential. Two, help him feel that this illness is no different than a peer who has juvenile diabetes or a thyroid condition. Mental illnesses are neurological issues at their core, and until we get this point across, we will continue to stigmatize mental illness. Thank you very much, Jen, for writing that email. Our hour has gone very quickly, but I want to thank our guests, Steve Miller of Cedar Rapids, Dr. Alan Witters, Chief of Psychiatry at Cedar Rapids Mercy Medical Center, Dan Strelner, President of Abbey, Inc., and Chris Hoffman, Executive Director of Pathways Behavioral Services. Thank you all for joining us.
Go Hawks.
All right. Thanks, Steve. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese and Cedar Falls. Help from Tony Daner. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about false confessions. We hope you'll tune in. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.